Clubhouse.
Welcome back to the final episode of Pod Clubhouse's coverage of FX's Shogun. This is Paul's Pod Clubhouse, joined once again with Inez and Gabby. How are you guys doing tonight?
Ready to rock and roll, Paul.
Excited, sad, all the emotions.
All the emotions. Will we find other TV this good this year? That remains to be seen.
What are you talking about? We have Beacon 23.
Well, we do have that. We do have four more episodes of that, that's for sure. But after that, man, I don't know. I'll keep my ear to the ground. Gabby, you want to start us off with the synopsis for this episode?
Yeah, before the credits, we have a flash forward and then a flashback. Flash forward is of Blackthorne as an old man. Flashback is of the scene, the tragic scene with Mariko. Yabu fucked up.
He made his choice. He finally made his choice, didn't he? Later, Toranaga releases his falcon into the sky to bear many daughters.
And then his family comes back to Edo with Lady Mariko.
Elsewhere in Osaka, the regents meet and they agree to go to war after Lady Ochiba decides for them that they will honor Mariko with an actual funeral. This is interesting timing for this decision, though, because there's an earthquake, and earthquakes bear a lot of symbolism.
Ah, that's true. And then our guy Blackthorne and Yabu made it back to Edo thanks to Mariko arranging Blackthorne's safety.
In a bittersweet scene with Lady Ochiba in the air, together they finish Mariko's death poem and send it to Toranaga.
Yeah, and then on the way back, Yabu goes kooky dooks and then offers diving lessons to Blackthorne and trying to convince him to just flee the country.
He kind of loses his shit, doesn't he? Go back to England.
Yeah, Yabu can always count on him.
When they come ashore, Omi is there with all the bros, and Yabu is sentenced to death with Toranaga okaying the idea of being his second.
Yeah, I think he wanted it that way. And then Toranaga gets the letter from Lady Ochiba with her death poem and possibly a coded message.
Blackthorne goes to speak to Toranaga and tries to kill himself with the knife through the heart move that you guys made note of earlier with Mariko. But he is stopped by Toranaga and given permission to rebuild his ship and start building a fleet.
Right. And then Yabu, who is sentenced to kill himself, has a conversation with Toranaga, and Toranaga gives him the whole plan. We learn everything.
We do.
We could just skip all the way there, and then we're good.
Yeah.
Just kidding. There's plenty of good stuff.
That's the main idea.
Well, the ladies are good, and then skip to that.
Blackthorne takes Fuji out on a rowboat, and they cast the ashes of Fuji's relatives into the sea.
Very well said, Paul. And then finally, you know, Blackthorne and the rest of the surviving men, they have moments with each other of camaraderie.
Pulling rope.
Pulling rope and nodding heads.
The title of this episode was A Dream of a Dream. Let me read you something from the epilogue of the book where this title was pulled from. It's a little bit different than how the show ends, but you'll get an idea. This is Toranaga. He's just talking to himself for pages at the end of the book. Okay. He says, "In a year or two, without ceremony, I will resign in Sudara's favor." Sudara is his other son that's not Naga, "and retain power as usual and keep my eyes firmly on Osaka Castle. I will continue to wait patiently, and one day those two usurpers inside will make a mistake, and when they do, they will be gone, and somehow Osaka Castle will be gone, and just another dream within a dream, and the real prize of the great game that began as soon as I could think, which became possible the moment the Taiko died, the real prize will be won, the shogunate."
I like it. Mm-hmm. I like that. That's pretty close to the, you know, reality, historical reality.
Toranaga definitely had me fooled the entire time, both book and show. No, I don't want to be Shogunin. No, not me, Doug. No. No.
Well, you know what? Then the TV, the miniseries prevailed for you, yeah? Because I think until the very end, he reluctantly agreed to it.
I think that little bit with Yabu bringing up the battle that almost happened between the Taiko and Toranaga when he's kind of freaking out in the little pond with the Shido. And he mentions how that also was impacted by an earthquake, creating like this omen about whether or not they should actually fight or whatever. I think that's supposed to draw some attention to this maybe restlessness or long game that Toranaga's had ever since then. Ever since before Taiko brought peace, he had to win the peace, right? And he convinced Toranaga not to keep fighting and be just a really big deal daimyo.
You're saying that that was in the book or that was in the miniseries?
That was in the book, but and only kind of hinted at with that mention of that scene by Yabu in the show.
Okay.
But not totally clear, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it was just supposed to understand that Toranaga has been plotting this a long time, since before the Taiko's reign actually began.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
We've kind of been speculating that the entire season. Did that sound self-serving? And they did get me with Mariko's death for a moment where I'm like, no, I cannot accept it. Even though I still knew logically it would make sense that, you know, he still was on his plan. I did let myself, and I think I mentioned it on the podcast, that I was personally so hurt of her situation and her life that, and processing my emotions, I just needed to believe that this really was for the Japan, you know, for the good of Japan, not for the good of Toranaga. So, but I'm really glad that we got the excerpt from the book shared there, Paul, because that makes it the intent super clear. Because I think that even after this finale, you could still guess or believe that Toranaga did do this still for the good of the realm. He just like also got to like, you know, he got to have his cake and eat it too by getting to get Shogunate while he's at it.
Oh gosh, do you think that that's having cake and eating it too though? Like, how is this cake spoiled? I mean, crappy life.
His entire like thing was about honoring Japan and making sure that like nobody believes that they're higher than the realm. That is like what he had been preaching, because that's like the popular and honorable message, regardless if he really felt that like in his heart, right? As his purpose. I don't know about that, but in order for him to obtain Shogunate and all that power, people would probably respect it more because he, in his actions and what's documented in history, is that like he was directly responsible for the era of peace and uniting the realm. So therefore, we're not going to fight him on like this Shogunate obtaining that goal because he did it good for the realm. That's him having his cake and eating it too. Not that he felt his purpose was to service Japan. It was that he got to get his power and everybody in Japan still gets the reunion that they need.
I want to bring up like the historical stuff at the end.
Okay.
Historical differences. Yeah. At the end, after we chat about all this.
Okay. We've been, for the last several episodes, we've been just kind of starting with chronologically going through the episode. Do we just want to do that again?
Yeah. I think we have to. I think it's the only way.
All right. Well, that opening scene is a source of some confusion with the old man on death's door. Clearly, it's old Blackthorn. He's got the spoils of his misadventure in Japan there, but he's clearly in England with little English grandsons going to chop their little fingers off with his katana.
How old is he? Like 200? Like, who looks pretty like ancient. That?
He looked pretty old.
Yeah, he's like a great.
Well, I mean, the life expectancy in 1600 wasn't like that old, right? Especially for like a pirate.
Yeah, he's not a pirate.
Oh, right, jeez. Right. So it all depends on which way you're looking at it, but yes.
Yeah, he's an ancient.
He's an Anjin.
Anyway, yeah. So that was a source of confusion, but the key to it was noticing that rosary. Is that called a rosary?
It is called a rosary, yes.
Yes. So that's a clue everyone should have kept in mind. And then right after the credits, Todonaga gives up his falcon. What do you think that symbolism was there? Is he giving up? Is he into a new era? He was probably, I think he was looking at water. We said that staring at water meant new beginnings. Give that falcon some meaning. What was it, Inez?
Well, I'm just thinking of reflecting on kind of like how the falcon was used in like his stories and lessons and stuff with his son, right? And then like his falcon, I guess in one of the scenes, right, like did the selfish, self-serving thing example. And then Torunaga, I think, was the same scene that he kind of had this like little fit moment with his son, you know, like he did something that was not like being like this badass, I guess, whatever. So I'm just kind of taking pieces of it throughout the episode. And first of all, I fucking love that hawk ponytail.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That was very cute.
That was the cutest fucking thing I've ever seen in my life. It was so precious. I'm associating this hawk, this flawed hawk that looks really fucking cool and then is like really showy because he's a hawk, but he's got his little ponytail thing that he's, to me, a symbolic for Torunaga. Does that seem like it's feasible?
No wrong answers.
Okay. Well, I guess like the releasing of it could be, I don't know, maybe it's like the releasing of the constraint because he now could see his strategy unfolding and he was release of like the plans and everything because everything's already underway and he already has his eye on the prize and it's going to happen. So he's just freeing himself. Maybe
just sit and watch. Right.
Yeah.
Or maybe the Falcon was, right. Maybe the Falcon was more symbolic with Mariko because he would have been learning of her death and that kind of stuff right near there in sequence of like time. Mm-hmm. And he had referred to hawks or falcons as more or less as just kind of like tools, you know, like things that you have to kill other things. And that is how he played Mariko. She, you know, she was in on it. She agreed to the whole thing. But that is still clearly what he did. He moved her like a chess piece and used her like he would a falcon. Yeah. What do you got, Gabby? Straighten us out.
Yeah, that's a really good one. Yes, it was consensual puppeteering. I think that's a really good perspective you have there. Piggybacking off of both of you guys, it can represent the future, the change that Japan is about to experience, because Torunaga's era was one that lasted, you know, a couple centuries or a couple and a half, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that, yeah, it's probably also symbolic of how things are going to just roll differently, because he did establish a completely change of system, of societal system, government, everything. So no need for this form of like puppeteering anymore. Now it's bare daughters because it's like a different strategy that he's using to rule and change in the future. But it also, I mean, he didn't live long after this, so it could also symbolize him giving up on the grand plans, retiring. Anyway, I like what you guys said. That was really nice. Especially you, Paul, because I hadn't thought of that. You've come so far. So anyway, yeah, so soon after that his baby arrives back in Edo, his family gets there, and I thought it was interesting that he said at least he has another son, right? Because Naga
was, I think he said, I have other sons, plural. You know, because he's got like what, how many consorts? So yeah,
I know, but are they daughters or are they sons?
I thought I heard sons, but, well, I would have had to have read sons since I don't know Japanese.
Yeah, so you read sons. Okay, yeah, so that was really interesting because when someone mentioned that to him earlier, he, at least to me, he looked like he was a little bit offended. And then when he said it, he had a smile on his face. So I'm like, how do you say that to your son's mom? Like, he just died.
Right.
How are you like, oh, yeah, this woman gave me a baby. Like, yours was just, you know, backup, firstborn backup.
Right. Win some, you lose some.
Yeah, so that was kind of interesting, but whatever, I'll overlook it.
I mean, I think that just feeds into what we've been learning of the deeply rooted cultural expectations of purpose. Mm-hmm. Right. So
you're right.
You know, they're all growing up. They all like know it. So she might not. She's sad, but like she also is bought into this controlled environment that has convinced her and gaslighted her into that this is all purpose. So it's very romanticized for their control. And then, yeah. So she's like, yeah, you're right.
Oh, my God. I cannot believe I forgot that point. Thanks, Inez. Gosh, last episode just kind of wiped everything out for me. I forgot the entire series has treated everything this way. Right. I mean, the next significant scene was that region meeting.
Yeah. They finally agree that it's time to go to war. They all seem to agree. And there's the two things. There's Ochiba having a voice in that meeting. I think that's probably unheard of up until that point that she had a voice in the meeting. And then the earthquake that made them be like, wait a second, maybe that's a sign we shouldn't be doing this.
I guess what sort of significance do you think played from, you know, Ishido saying that the omens are all bullshit and that everybody needs to stop being superstitious, etc. Like, that was a real insult to the culture, right?
I mean, and he's surrounded by all these various perspectives, right? He's got the... And that wasn't that Kiyama that said that about needing to reconsider? And so he's a Christian, also having this superstitious take on earthquakes. You know, I don't like Ishido, but I don't exactly blame him for being like, God damn it. You know?
I know. I know, enough talking.
But it matches like his personality and everything is that he's a little bit more reactive or impulsive, like, and he's really like ambitious. So he's like right here at the finish line. I don't remember. I thought it was him who said, you know, was trying to convince everybody that Torunaga was probably responsible for the raid that killed Mariko. I think he's just trying to drive this home. You know, he's like, the finish line is right fucking there.
But yeah, definitely he is. Both of those things, grasping straws because the finish line is right there.
Yeah, and everyone called bullshit for sure.
Well, it did seem like a very tenuous kind of thing there, even before the earthquake, because no one believed what Ishido was saying, but they also felt like the time was up with this Torunaga business, and they were all brought there to see it that way. You know, the two new regents and the other two regions that have been there the whole time, plus Ishido. Time was just up on this issue.
Yeah, and he lost his power and he lost his respect. I mean, the earthquake was the final straw. Obviously, the fact that Mariko was granted the permit to leave was the first like hit at Ishido. And then once they killed Mariko, everyone was angry. And that was the second strike. And the earthquake, I think, was the third strike. I wish that we could see like what's going to happen to him, because I think he's completely powerless. And it was interesting, right? Because right after that, he had his conversation with Yabu, and he's, you know, confidently saying that, you know, Yabu's going to inherit land and Izu, and then become a regent and whatever. And like, surely he did not believe that. Do you think?
I think Omi will inherit the Kishigi mantle, but it wasn't very firm on what lands and other titles he would inherit. Yeah, I wasn't totally clear on that yet. But, you know, Torunaga likes Omi. He appreciates his cleverness and loyalty.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But Ishido is the one who promised Yabu, but surely he knows that when Yabu gets back, he's going to be forced to.
Yeah, I think the unwritten rules of honor and all that everybody gets. Right. So he knows very well, like when Yabu's freaking out on the boat, like, give me diving lessons, let's steal the ship, let's go someplace else, because he knows.
Do you think that he was actually, you know, suffering some PTSD in that scene, or was he just doing theatrics in front of Ishido jumping into the pond with the catfish?
I'm not totally aware of how that particular diagnosis would apply there. I think it maybe is just his nerves. Like, he knows he's finally made this very decisive act that can't be taken back.
Okay.
And he's being sent back home. How's he going to collect on anything if he's sent back home to the guy who he betrayed?
I think that this could be considered a PTSD kind of thing, because it's such a certainty that he is going to die and he knows it. He's, from the very beginning, has been caught in the impossible pool between two tycoons, and they fucking know it. They know they're doing that and they're just using him. Neither one of them really give a shit about him as a person. He's just a pawn, but his torture is that he is just this little toy that they're using, and this little tool that they know is completely disposable. So I can see that now he finally gets to the crossroads where he's facing death. Gabby, I think you mentioned it from the very beginning, because he's, from episode one, has contemplated death and methods of dying in great detail, great depth. He had a record and ranking of all the different ways that he's witnessed people dying. And so I felt like in that moment where he's losing his mind is because he's still fighting with the acceptance that this really is his reality, that he is definitely going to die and there's no way around it. And somebody could definitely go into some kind of manic state.
So you think he was that way because of what was to come, not necessarily because of what had just happened with Mariko?
Yeah, I don't know for sure if it's guilt-driven. I think there is some guilt, because I think that he's been like very kind of, in his way, affectionate with Omi. So we know there is a softness to him. His humor, everything, like there's just a softness to his personality. So I feel like he definitely could be grieving, like having some guilt over the Mariko situation. But death is such a normal, constant thing. And people he's been close to, like all the time, like he expects like the death of them. I don't see why he would feel guilty, particularly for Mariko, when they really, in the entire episode, haven't had anything to pull them in as comrades at any point through any of this, except for the last episode, Mariko's last episode, when he's like insulting her poem. Maybe that's like the closest kind of personal, real interactions I've ever seen from them. So I can't imagine it's the guilt. I feel like self-service, taking care of himself, looking out for himself, I think that's probably what's eating at him the most.
Well, no, I think it's probably just the first thing, just the processing of what is to come, that it's going to be D-Day. He's going to have to show up and kill himself in those last moments that he's obsessed with, right? He's going to find out what they're going to be like for him. But what I found interesting about this scene, I don't know, I just thought of it now, and I didn't think of this before, but I think that Ishido, in this scene, when he looks at Yabu as Yabu's in the pond, and he said, gather your army and wait for my command, or return to Edo, gather your army and wait for my command. His face looked defeated and like sympathetic. It had different emotions that I hadn't seen, kind of like being lost. And so it makes me think that Yabu is just expressing like how Ishido feels. I think Ishido knows that this is over. Yeah. I think he feels like he was grasping at straws and he's about to walk to his death, just as Yabu is.
Do you want to know what happens to Ishido?
Yes.
In the book?
Yeah.
Why, of course.
About 2 or 3 weeks after the end of the book, Ishido is captured by Torunaga's people. And he is buried up to his neck.
Oh, yeah.
I think in Osaka, where he survives, I think, like 2 or 3 days of people tossing rocks at him and kicking him in the face and stuff like that. And and yeah, that's his end. He does not survive very long.
Yeah, yeah, according to that book. Yes, so that's sad. So then we know that's what's getting foreshadowed with that scene, I guess.
The very end scene has like a different fate, a possible fate, I guess, since this episode has got other possible projections forward, you know, with Blackthorn as old man Blackthorn, maybe what Toranaga explains to Yabu during Yabu's death scene is what he presupposes will happen, but isn't necessarily what will happen.
Yeah, I'll have to wonder. So the flashback or the flash forward with Blackthorn, after all this happens, that's when he wakes up. So he missed Mariko's funeral.
Yeah.
And I know that the old man flashbacks happen like in the very beginning. And then I think here, like kind of in the beginning or first quarter. And then that's when he wakes up. And so to me, I kind of gathered that that was like a flash forward dream state that he had, like a vision that he had during his being unconscious from his injury.
Hmm.
Did you? Yeah. I guess I don't think Inez gathered that.
I did not at all. I thought that was the future. And when I saw him like jolt wake up, I thought that that was us coming back to present day. So that's how I proceeded for the rest of the story.
Well, could you imagine though? Because right after he wakes up, like he has this huge headache. He was just in this little coma. And then he's walked to the freaking forest holding Mariko's rosary. Like, and he knew he was marching to his death. Can you... I just feel bad for Blackthorn. Like, he really is a prisoner in this place. Just thinking about how he's, you know, volunteering to do all of this because, you know, he knows he has no choice. It was interesting. I guess every character, right, has, like, their ending in here. And so his story from the beginning to now has just been a caged bird. And, you know, at the end, he's still... like indefinitely going to be caged.
Yeah.
Thanks to Toranaga's sabotage. Yeah. So watching him like be this defeated and limping and hurt was just very sad to me.
Yeah. When the priest revealed that he was meant to die there, but Mariko negotiated for his life, I did cry. I really did. I did cry at that point, just thinking about Mariko, and because she's super intelligent, she's a strategist as well. And so I was crediting her with like adding that element into whatever this big Toranaga plan was that she was executing. She was going to like play her cards take care of him. And that made me cry.
It's just so sad that Blackthorn's been through all of this. Meanwhile, like this priest is just... I don't know. He's just fine. I mean, he gets his hair cut every day, probably. He's clean all the time. He's in the middle of all the drama and still is perfectly safe. Like, it's really interesting, the sad contrast between these two.
Yeah.
In that scene for me.
If it's any consolation, in his history doesn't...
Oh, yeah.
the real guy basically kick out all the Christians. And if you're not going to convert back to anything besides Christianity, you can go ahead and die now.
Oh, yeah. No, that did. Yeah, that did happen in real life for sure. So, but we're not talking about that right now.
We're not talking about that, Paul. All right.
Yeah, no, that does happen in real life, which is great. And so, okay, so when Toranaga released his falcon and he said, go bear daughters. Okay, so I feel like it's one or two reasons. One reason, because he's saying go bear daughters, because if you never have a son, then you like aren't competition. Like it's kind of like a, I'm always going to be on top. No one else is going to whatever be. I know the falcon can't be Shogun, but it could either be that. Like, go be good, but don't be too good. It be or is
Shogun
it...
Shogun of the bird world.
Or is it of the bird world? Not of the skies, of the bird world. Or is it that he said go bear daughters because bearing daughters is largely, like, what made him and his legacy successful in real life. I don't know which one it is, but I feel like it's one or both.
Like, go bear daughters, like, because there's more tools, more, like yeah. Start your future tools. These come in handy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
My bird me.
They have that line, he needed a woman to do what an army couldn't do, right? Is that what mm-hmm. you're kind of tying that into? Even though Mariko wasn't exactly his daughter, his son that they decided to show wasn't of much use.
Well, he played his part,
I guess.
And it had to be through death, I guess. He was most useful in death.
He was.
All right, after that, Blackthorn sheds his tears because he's grateful for Mariko. And then we have Lady Ochiba having this special moment with her son where they write the poem.
And I enjoyed that scene because we've seen Lady Ochiba really need to be certain kinds of ways with, say, Ishido. She's got to be guarded and submissive, but also domineering in a way that she can be in private with him, but maybe not in front of other people. So she's had to have these personas, but mother to the heir persona, we've not gotten a whole lot of. And that was sweet that she doesn't have to be those other personas with him. You know, he says some dumb suggestion to the poem. And oh
my God, dumb. What an idiot child. Oh my gosh.
And she's politely corrects him with, well, what about we try this? And yeah, I actually really enjoyed seeing that side of her.
Yeah, that gentle parenting at work. It was a very sweet scene.
Yeah, and that is her purpose, right? So that's nice. Mariko helped her keep that. And then a great scene over here with Yabu and Blackthorn. And I don't know if you guys noticed, but I thought I saw a little rainbow in the mist. I don't know if that meant anything, but I liked it.
You know, I didn't notice.
Yeah, when he's walking down, I thought it was a couple little rainbows from some mist. Anyway, though, it's really interesting seeing these two, right? First episode versus last episode. Complete switch where Blackthorn's the one that's together and honorable and...
Well, has a future.
Yabu's losing it.
Potentially, anyway.
Oh, you're right. You're right. Because Blackthorn did think he was going to die and he was freaking out because of that. And now Yabu's freaking out because he knows he's going to die.
Yeah, well, at that point, Yabu was conniving and trying to keep the presence of the Erasmus and their crew from Toranaga, but only through spies did Toranaga learn about the boat. And so this is the final result of all the conniving, is he came up snake eyes on this, and here he is to face his sentence.
We mentioned the diving, but that was so significant. How he's saying, teach me how to dive, blah, blah, blah. Like, that was him trying to show himself as, like, a worthy leader. And he's just trying to imitate Toranaga. Mm-hmm. Like, verbatim. That was kind of funny.
Yeah.
And I think, like, showed a little bit more about, I think, who Yabu was at the end of the day. Not original. Just scheming. And trying to survive because he knew he could never reach too high up the ladder.
But losing his shit.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. He is going to die. So never mind. But they blamed the Christians, right? Right after that.
Yeah. Well, what did you two think seeing Erasmus burned and on the bottom of the sea there?
I mean, I knew Toranaga did it because Toranaga had no intention of letting him go anywhere. I didn't know that they would blame it on Mariko telling them that it was an exchange for his life, etc. I don't know if Toranaga told her to do that part or not, but I think either way, the ship is going to get destroyed. And I think Toranaga explained that later on, too.
I think I was just kind of accepting the story as like it was coming. So when they do see the ship fall and Blackthorn has assessed that this is Mariko's like doing, I did... At that point, like, just accepted that as the writers are giving me this information as fact. Toranaga talking through his story relating to that, I liked that I was left with a kind of those curiosities of, like, how detailed did he have to go? Because, you know, he was able to base a lot of decisions and actions where he does something, but he doesn't control all the steps in between that and the outcome he's waiting for, because he's just trusting like what he understands about how each person behaves. And so
right,
just
like Jess.
Yeah. So I didn't like land on anything definitive about that other than he's just like incredibly observant, just a brilliant strategist in this way. And then I felt like I was just learning that like he really doesn't, I felt like he has no humanity. Like he did go through real suffering and all of it is based off of the infrastructure of this romanticized purpose existence, right? And I 100% believe that he felt very confident in his plans that he could take him or leave him, and that he really was purely entertained with this like element that now exists in their daily life, because he's an old guy and he's experiencing 1500 new, China, 1500 Japan, right? Like all of his life. Yeah. And then this is just this like new funny thing that just exists, and he doesn't have any respect for it. It's such a low piece of it. So it is really just entertainment. But we got to know Mariko and Blackthorn and Yabu to the depths. What I just got from it was he's very callous and very... It's a sociopath.
Well, I mean, any good leader has kind of got to, you know, make decisive, hard choices. And again, his whole idea was to create peace. And that's not a nice journey. And it didn't even look nice, like, at the end. And, you know, in real life, you know, he did, like, expel the Christians. He did... basically he did close the borders completely except like to China, and just made everybody just like really learn their culture. He established class systems so nobody could move within their class, right? Like Ishido was like a poor person, and then he came up to almost become shogun. Torunaga definitely made sure that could never happen again. So he did establish a lot of rules that I think now people would think are like bad or sort of negative in society. But that is what it took in order to create peace. And what he wanted was to create peace because he was born in the wars and with all the murder, and he just wanted that to stop. Again, that's his agenda, right? Like means to an end. And for something like that, you can't really be a diplomat. You can pretend to be. But you kind of have to just not have.
Yeah, for sure. These are the rules of this environment. So that is what it takes. But I felt like the point of this story to me has been that they intentionally have taught us all season long the deepest levels of suffering and isolation and oppression that these amazing characters have endured. Buntaro is an amazing character, right? He's the closest thing you can get to a super soldier of their era. And what's the human cost of that? He's super repressed. He's very abusive.
I think you need to listen to Mariko's words and stop being trapped in your own reality.
And it doesn't take away that he's a human, right? And then I'm getting to that, right? Because Mariko like is the most impressive character that we see, and we've seen also like her extreme loyalty to her role in this and being amazing at all these things that have brought her utility up as a translator, as a lady, as a samurai. But like, what's the cost? The cost is that she also has to suppress emotions. They have to compartmentalize so deeply within themselves to achieve on it. And she never relented, no matter what, to her mission. And this is like everybody. So they spent the entire season showing us the depths of each of these characters. And then finale just shows you, like, through Torunaga's eyes, that he's so disconnected from them on the humanity point, right? So it's just kind of like showing like reality, like it is so easy to be able to just like toss around these lives to achieve the bigger goal that is probably best for humanity in the long run. But this is the human cost of it. And this is like really what it looked like. I didn't even take Torunaga talking about like, you know, we got it done with like sending a woman in there. I don't think that this was a brag on women. I felt like he was kind of like, these people are like, I'm so much smarter than them that I beat them just using a woman, because we know how low he thinks of women. So I don't know. My interpretation of this last episode is kind of like stripping some of the romanticization that we kind of automatically give our protagonists.
Well, you sound conflicted, right? Because you sound very like Western and modern, along with like trying to maintain context for the time period. It's like you can't have both. It's just going to be constant conflict. So you got to pick one. And I choose to tell you that it is you who are trapped, Inez. If you seek individual freedom, you will never be free. Lady Mariko. So anyway, you're trapped in your Western propaganda. So at the end of the day, those are conflicting philosophies that you have there. And it is difficult to watch this because of the conflict. Obviously, you're right. Like, there is misogyny, there is sexism, there is like complete disrespect. Like, as a woman, I know that, feel that. But then just for the sake of the storytelling and the message that they're trying to relay, of course, as a woman, like, I will never receive that message, like, wholeheartedly, because I'm not, like, of that culture and of that time. But really, really deeply trying to strip my womanhood and own philosophies. I'm just going through this through like a shogun's eyes, or yeah, just with the time and the context. Then it is a situation that really, you know, there are no wrong answers and there are all wrong answers. At the end of the day, you just need to pick, are you a means girl or an ends girl? And I'm going to choose the ends, just because I feel like at the end of the day, if this hadn't have happened historically, then they would not have achieved like the peace that would have allowed them to grow so much, like with their technology and with their within their culture. And so it's sad that, you know, so many people are sacrificed, specifically women, but, you know, I guess necessary. That's what I choose to respond to you on that.
Well, let's move on.
Yeah, I think shortly after that is, I was impressed with Omi that he, you know, tattled.
Well, there
what
was,
you think about that?
There was Omi who had to turn in or arrest Yabu, but there were other people that needed to kind of squeal on Yabu, right? From the incident in Osaka, people like staff and ladies, I can't remember exactly who, but it wasn't just Omi that needed to cooperate in order to bring down Yabu's reign of terror.
Yeah, it was Mariko's lady-in-waiting who was present for the death.
Right. It was a combination of things like this is one where I confuse the book stuff, but in the book, someone saw him let the bad guys in the gate.
Oh, yeah. They did mention that in this.
Pretty definitive.
Right. Yep. And then he seemed really guilty and apologized.
This is interesting for Omi, right? Because he was Team Yabu for so long and would even kind of...
Still Team Yabu.
And still... Well, and kind of shit-talk Torunaga's decisions with Yabu when he was with Yabu. But in that last episode or two, we saw where he was starting to become Team Torunaga.
I think he was Team Consistency and Team Honor, and Yabu just did the unforgivable. Like, you just can't switch sides like that.
Yeah, he wasn't on those teams.
Well, yeah, you're just not allowed to switch sides, okay? That's the rule. Just pick a side. Yeah, Omi didn't like his side, but, you know, at least he stuck to it and he got to live. Do you think that Omi finally became a man? I know you've been talking about how he's kind of a dummy in your book.
Oh, no. He has come quite a long way. I think had the ship not landed in his little town, he would have continued to be a happy, small-time village boss man, boning Kiku at his leisure. And that would have been fine. So he's had to undergo this evolution that was thrust upon him. And he's needed to learn a lot. Like, he is truthful when he tells Yabu that he's learned a lot from him. What it is that he learned might have been the value of loyalty and sticking with your word and your honor. And it may not be the lessons that Yabu thought he was teaching him.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, Omi's had a lot of growth in all this. He's ambitious and he's intelligent. And being in the good graces of Torunaga, and hopefully Torunaga will honor Yabu's will so he'll be able to build his wealth. Like, I think the reward of all of what he's gone through, he's going to see the payoff, and it'll probably keep him more of a loyal type than a Yabu type as he ages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. he earned his ranking in Torunaga's book, which is like, you know, he respected Omi more than he respected his son and Yabu. So it did work out in Torunaga's favor, according to this show. And the fact that he wanted Blackthorn to do it, do you think that Blackthorn would have tried to fight that? Why do you think Torunaga didn't let him second Yabu's death?
Maybe like seconding somebody, it seems to be a role of great honor. And yeah, since Torunaga revealed that he actually doesn't have any respect for Anjin, you know, that he thinks that Yabu like deserved better.
Interesting. I didn't think that. I don't think he respects Yabu.
I think he does. They peed off the side of a wall together. They've been together for a long time. They've known each other for a long time. And
Blackthorn went diving with him.
Yeah, but that's their entertainment.
Sure, they peed off of a ship at some point. And I think that I thought we talked about this too. I think they peed off of the wall, like, because Torunaga was doing that to leverage him and to test him. Because, I mean, he's been using Yabu as a puppet this whole time.
Yeah.
And always he knew he was betraying him.
He used Yabu in the way that he knew Yabu would falter.
Right, right. Know? So I don't know how you can really respect someone like that, though.
I think that...
Because at least Blackthorn saved his life a couple times.
True. I don't know. I just feel like the camaraderie, like their conversation that they had, that seems... You know, it seems like a important conversation, a respect in there. I mean, if he didn't respect Yabu, he could have also declined for himself to be the second and be like, no.
I think he had pleasure in, he wanted to like do it himself because he would have had pleasure in it because finally, yeah, full circle.
Could totally been that too, for sure. Great possibility. Yeah,
if this motherfucker wants to keep Blackthorn around for like entertainment, then why not also take out Yabu? Because you know he's wanted to for a long time, been super annoyed at him.
Slight difference in the book there, and it works better for the show with the way, instead of like I read earlier, that epilogue that Torunaga recites to himself for a very, 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 very long time, it's better to say some of that stuff to somebody, which is what he did with Yabu. In the book, he's just like, Yabu, just take care of that yourself. And Omi brings him Yabu's head as proof. But Torunaga is not directly involved.
I like that more than this. I feel like it made more sense for Torunaga to keep it to himself. But I guess that little line of why am I... Like, he didn't tell Yabu everything. And he did say, why tell the future to a dead man? That was kind of like cruel. Then we meet up with we go to the sad house, right? It's super dark, nothing going on, and Blackthorn and Fuji don't have a translator while they're chatting it up about their future.
Yeah, tiny book difference there too. Torunaga will allow Fuji to become a nun, as she says, but she actually would rather just commit seppuku. And he doesn't want to give her permission to do that directly, but because I guess, you know, her family lineage, et cetera, being Hiramatsu's relation, whatever. But he does suggest that she might have an accident in the woods between here and the monastery or wherever she would go. So if that were to happen, that would just be a tragedy, but... Mm-hmm. Things happen in the woods.
Yeah. So maybe that would be something that would happen in this as well.
That couldn't not happen with what we've seen here.
Aw, that's so sad. But yeah, the contrast in this episode so far with all the rest, with the housing accommodations and everything, it's just there was complete darkness. I think the only time there was any sort of warm light was when we had the Lady Ochiba scene with her son. So very somber. And then,
well, even that next morning with the rock garden meditation, that's still pretty dreary.
Oh, right, with Blackthorn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then even when Torunaga like saw his sun, there's fire, so I guess there was a little bit of warm light, but it still also seemed
overcast,
pretty depressing. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of yellow. So maybe there's like a bit of hope symbolized in that as well, obviously. But mm-hmm. yeah, that's when he received that coded letter.
Yeah, yeah.
Which his wife 100% read. And she totally got it because she's a smart lady.
She had to say, of course not, or whatever her reply was. But she's got to know.
I took it for her word. I did not like assume that she did read it, but I thought her response was super cute. So that's funny. I was way off.
What'd you think of that yeah. bookend scene with Omi and Blackthorn with the "I will need your sword and guns"?
And then he gave it to him?
And then he gave it to them. Remember, there was a very big mm-hmm. scene at the beginning of the show where...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, full circle.
Yeah.
He got pee-peed on. Yeah. Again, lots of growth and sadness. All these men are forced to think about themselves and their lives in the overcast weather. No ladies to hide behind or fight for anymore.
Well, he's understanding Japan and Japanese, his role, when to fight, what to fight about. His boat's burned. He knows that. Fuji's gone.
Totally defeated.
Right. Yeah. He's out of allies, but also I think there's some level of acceptance there because he just mm-hmm. pulls it out and hands it over.
Yeah, he knows the rules. But like seeing Fuji, you know, with her urns was really sad. And then him asking her to stay. What did you guys think about that scene?
He was so desperate. Sad. He just needed one friend he could count on.
I know. Were you hoping? Was there some bit of hope inside that like made you think that she would actually stay for him?
Book Fuji wasn't interested, but that doesn't mean that show Fuji couldn't be. So yeah, it was, she knew that the house did not run in a Japanese style and that although they weren't really calling him the barbarian anymore, she knew that he was still very unaccustomed to their ways and rough around the edges, but she also knew that he was much more compassionate and kind than he let on to everybody else. And actually in the book, they'd actually had sex at some point. Believe it or not.
I choose to not.
Yeah, they had. But I was still hoping against all that knowledge that she would have decided to stay anyway or give it another 6 months or whatever. But nope.
I did not think that she would be moved by that. Her mission and, you know, she negotiated her term of her contract and she got it fulfilled and she had a different purpose and she's very disciplined in the stuff that she wants to get done because she needs to get it done. And Anjin was only part of that one specific contract and it was over. So I did not think that he would. I felt so sad for Blackthorn. Because it's like mm-hmm. His life was spared for what? There's nothing for him anymore. This quiet in the house and everything is fucked up. So it was just super tragic and I felt really heartbroken for him. And I think it was a really great scene to precede their next scene that we see later on.
And then the kind of transition scene after that, I think was like, chopping, it was like village people and it was chopping fish heads and sweeping the front steps. It's kind of like a life goes on vibe.
Sort of. That was when Torunaga was quote unquote looking for the Christians. And so there was putting on heads on spikes. And that was kind of a crazy ass scene, right? The persecution mm-hmm. of the village.
Yeah, yeah. Especially because he did it himself. Knew.
Yeah.
He did it. Right, exactly.
So who do you think he was actually getting? Do you think he was like trying to actually find the spies or was he finding like innocent people and he didn't care?
Maybe it was just people who are Christian because of like Paul said from the book that it was like, if you're not going to leave Christianity, then you can fuck off and die.
You're a traitor, yeah.
Or maybe Yabu loyalists, if that's a thing. Although the people in town yeah. didn't really like Yabu either. They liked Omi, but not Yabu.
Yeah, but, you know, he definitely had spies, whether they liked him or not. You know, they didn't have a choice, so... Let's just say that there was some kind of underlying purpose that we don't know about. I mean, is that just super, super evil? Because we're still Team Torunaga, somewhat, right?
I mean, this is just the true cost. This is the human cost.
Yeah. In another canon, this is the Emperor in Star Wars, right? Depending on your point of view, the human cost of law and order across the galaxy. Yes, you will lose a few lives along the way, and it does take many years of planning, but it's very similar thematically.
Mm-hmm. No doubt that they pulled from feudal Japan for a lot of things. I mean, even the robes, right?
Oh, for sure.
I was thinking of you at your fan expo in your Anakin attire.
Yeah.
Every time I saw Blackthorn, I was like, is that Paul? Oh, no, it's not.
No.
He has blue eyes. Wait, what color eyes do you have?
Mine are greenish hazel.
There we go. So I said, no, this guy has blue eyes that can't be Paul.
Yeah, amongst other
Everything
reasons.
Else, though, looked exactly the same.
You think so? Oh, I'm flattered.
Yeah, so. Especially the robe. Anyway, though. So finally, it was kind of sad to me. Gosh, everything is sad. Seeing the spy, Torunaga spy, finally tell Blackthorn who he was. I forgot that Blackthorn, you know, has no idea what's going on at all. Like, at all times, he's just completely unaware. So I just felt even sadder for Blackthorn being lost and feeling smaller now.
Yeah, especially he had conversations with this man regularly, you know, so it's like, what? Like, this person was my friend and I still had like nothing. Like, I've just been fucked with.
Yeah.
Do you recall me describing the aborted seppuku scene from earlier in the book that Omi stopped?
I do not recall.
It took place much earlier in the course of the story, and it served a great purpose in convincing everybody that Blackthorn was a serious guy. He was adapting to their culture in a way that made him respectable, and he did actually get the sword, or the smaller sword, penetrated an inch into his chest. It did take a little bit to recover from before Omi managed to stop him. This is another example of the writers taking perfectly good scenes from the book and repurposing them in a way that's probably more meaningful on screen. It served its purpose well in the book, but here it just serves up a much more dramatic end, you know, for the two characters' relationship as we knew it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And then maybe giving us a hint on what it's going to look like in the future, potentially. Maybe these two are going to, I don't know, have a warmer relationship dynamic.
I mean, we could talk about that as closer to the end, but man, I've just, at some point, Blackthorn might figure out that he's getting dicked with. You know,
I think he already knows that.
You think so?
He's accepted it. Yeah, that's why he was trying to die. He's like, this sucks. This life sucks. But I guess my passion is building ships. And if I can do that, then that's my purpose. And his life got significantly smaller and he accepted that, I think.
They go into that his history wasn't sailing at the beginning. It was working for a ship's right. That's the right word. Shipbuilder. And his first, you know, 12 to 22 or so was spent doing that. So he has a pretty long history in knowing how to build ships.
Yeah, that was historically accurate, I think. I think that's what they said. So I'm glad that they included that. I mean, it's kind of fucked up. Could you imagine if he at any point earlier, you know, said he didn't hate the Catholics? Like, do you think that Torunaga would have given in with like, okay, cool, build your boat and help me out?
So like giving up on that old rivalry from his life in the West was like a fundamental aspect of his being that needed to be shed before he could trust him. Now he had to go through all that. He had to go through all that in a way, even potentially, I haven't thought about this, but giving some version of the last rites to Mariko in the words of, I guess, her faith is some giving into that, like, well, it doesn't matter anymore. It's not my God, your God. It's just God. I don't care.
Yeah, yeah. He did put her cross on his small sword when he attempted to stab himself. So in the little excerpt that you gave us, it did say that there was symbolism on that, right? Yeah, it did mention that. Yeah, a death of that old self and the old possible trajectory. I think I read that somewhere.
That's probably 600 text messages ago in our chat thread.
Probably. Anyway, yeah, so I think that they did hint a bit of some symbolism, because right before he did that, he did have a flash forward of his dead self. So I think that was like him making that choice on whether he, I think this is probably all foreshadow to the point where he dropped the cross, because that's him constantly choosing to go down this path, which is basically staying in Japan, because it's making the other path completely impossible. Mm-hmm. Anyway, right after that, we have Omi have his conversation with Yabu, his last conversation, right?
Yeah, on the way.
And Yabu told him.
To Yabu's end.
And Yabu professed his love to his son that he never had with the best death poem imaginable.
That's probably what it would sound like if I was forced to write one in a haiku type form like that. And it just sounds straightforward and dumb, like just like his.
Ines, do you think it was straightforward and dumb?
I did not think that his poem was dumb. It kind of felt like it reflects his guilt a bit there. His guilt for betrayal, not necessarily like guilt for Mariko. The guilt of having to do a betrayal, whatever conflict that his has with his moral code of honor, his honor code, and then just like, this is what I deserve, kind of thing. So I feel like that's...
Let's be real, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so... yeah, I didn't think it was dumb, but I was really sad with the scene, but it was such a great scene. I think this probably was my favorite scene. The interactions of Yabu with Omi, and then Yabu when he like gave his last will. We saw him all season long having to redo his will based off of what his decision on betrayal was going to be, because he was just expecting death all the time. Mm-hmm. I forgot to mention it when we were talking about his sentencing in the earlier part of the episode, you know, where he's like scrambling on the ground begging to go out with the cool death or whatever the word was, but he was like, give me a great death, like shoot me with a cannon or have like flesh-eating fish tear me apart. And I kind of interpreted that as like a like him Rolodexing in his mind all of the different ways he saw people die, and was just like, you know, I'll die really quickly and not feel something if I get blasted with a cannon. So I would like to do that instead of, you know, seeing everybody, you know, disembowel themselves already. That doesn't look like the most painless thing, right? It's kind of, you have to be really present and focused to like fulfill that and fight past your own pain.
I don't know. That guy who got shot up by the cannon didn't die right away, and Yabu saw that.
I know. Well, I guess he just thought it was really cool.
He just wanted a better story, yeah.
Something for people to talk about. Maybe there was some kind of like, you know, not necessarily fetish with the different deaths, but because of that hyperfixation that he had of needing to track it and study it and whatnot. I don't know. So I guess... In that sense, Gabby, you're saying like maybe seppuku is like boring for him. I was just like, I would like to hopefully get blasted very accurately on the cannon too, instead of having to stab myself and be alive and alert enough to keep pulling to one side to get the job done. But I really liked how he ended doing. Yeah. He was like, all right, it's time. And he just grabbed it with like a smile and just like, boom.
Just right before that, though, I just want to read his death poem. I think we need to honor it.
All right.
He said, my dead body, don't burn it, don't bury it, just leave it in a field and with it fill the belly of some hungry dog. And he laughed and said, impressive, right?
Well, the, he ends up dying on a cliff and his body, I think we see it fall over, don't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So well, that's some a full fishies circle moment. Got it. Yeah.
It's kind of a full circle thing because episode one was when he...
Yeah,
was that the cliff?
It's exactly. Challenge? It's not kind of. It is 100% a full circle moment. Yeah. They really are wrapping this up for us. But how did you feel about Yabu at the end of this, Paul? You were very anti-Yabu.
Well, I try to look at these kind of shows from the protagonist's perspective, and he's so slippery and wily. And were I in their shoes, I wouldn't know what to make of this guy, except that he's not super trustworthy because he's too ambitious and conniving. However, as a TV watcher, he also did a lot of entertaining things. And he was almost like, you know, the comedian from Watchmen, like that, just that concept of always having a smile on your face because you're making the best of the moment and you can, and it doesn't matter anyway, because you're going to die at some point anyway. So whatever. And that's kind of a lot of the attitude Yabu seemed to have through a lot of this thing. It was entertaining. As a TV watcher, I didn't hate him like that. I just, as a, were I there, I wouldn't have liked him.
I mean, who is a protagonist in this?
Mariko.
Yeah. Yeah. The story was basically hers. To do that, they needed to punch her up a little bit, make her more even, and introduce her earlier. Like, I think I mentioned earlier in the podcast, she's not mentioned until like 200 pages into the book. But in the TV show, we got her right away calming down Fuji during that heartbreaking scene up front. So, yeah, the Blackthorn is just, like we've been describing, is just a way for middle America to read this book about Japan. Oh, there's a white guy doing this fish out of water stuff. I understand that. But as we see plainly at the end, it was never his story. He was never important to anything that happened.
I still say he was important. It was a ripple, but it did have some kind of an impact because he did serve as a distraction, like in the story. And he did save Toranaga a couple of times.
Yeah, there's that. There's that.
And he did help Mariko have a better last moments of her life, moments being like last few months. I don't know, maybe in the miniseries, he was meant to have been part of convincing Fuji to become a nun instead of seppuku, right? They didn't insinuate that that was her plan, so maybe that was part of that. Because he did, at least in the show, provide the women with something positive every single time he was around them because he was of a different culture and treated them with more respect than they were used to. Or I guess in a different type of respect, I suppose. That was his purpose. He had some purpose. And then, I mean, he did like bring the cannon. He did land there and bring the cannons and that.
And then they sank the cannons. Meant something. In, at least in the book, they sank the cannons.
Yeah,
so that was... they didn't play a serious role in the book.
It was a nice distraction. It gave us a really good scene.
Yeah, that's for sure. Won't forget that.
I don't know. I did not like the conversation that Toranaga had with Yabu, where he like flashed forwards. And I kind of hated just how they worked out Ishido finally losing. And it was just because Lady Ochiba sent a letter. And that I don't know. I hated that. Because it's so like obviously inaccurate, like from history, but also like everyone was bitching about like the bureaucratic bullshit. And then that's just like what it ends up becoming at the end of this, the end, the beginning. I don't know. It just seemed too unrealistic for me.
That everybody would turn on Ishido when the heir's army didn't take the field.
Yes.
Yeah. It seemed like a lot of ifs. If this happens, if that happens, then everything works out for me.
I mean, because he's the Taiku, so he's the heir of the Taiku, and it's an honor thing. It's a code of conduct that they have been strictly...
Yeah, but not in real life.
I know, but in this story, like, there's just, that would be, make it consistent. I think that's why I didn't, like, question the possibility of it.
I mean, I think what makes this series so cool is that I felt like they were trying to have a middle ground and trying to keep it as, like, historically accurate as possible for what's going on in the book. And then it seems like the book had some more realistic stuff going on that this show just decided they wanted to completely omit because they wanted Toronaga to look like someone completely different. I just feel like they really, really softened a lot of things up to where I feel like it wasn't that necessary. Up until now, everything's so brutal and realistic, right? We say, okay, the honor, we just saw someone like take themselves out, you know, Hiromatsu in this way. We saw Mariko take herself out for the sake of honor. We see so much bloodshed. And then at the end, it's like when there's actually going to be the war. But I guess Mariko did say that they're spilling blood to save the greater bloodshed. I guess that could be the message. You needed these few significant people to die so that all the little people, soldiers wouldn't die or samurai wouldn't die. I'm like, come on, Toronaga, you're a badass. And this was not badass to me. I mean, he did like chop off a head, though. So that was badass.
All season, we all had been hoping for some samurai action. And he describes a battle kind of lining up, but we don't get to see hardly anything resembling samurai action. Did that disappoint you?
No. I think that it wasn't about seeing bloodshed on the screen. I think that the real story of Toronaga, who he's based off of Tokugawa, I think that his tactics, his strategy, and what he did to get the end goal, right, that Toronaga was trying to pursue, I think that that was still a very, like, admirable thing. I think it's still worth storytelling about. And so the fact that, like, none of that at all, it's like there were some ties, and then finally here it just, like, chopped it all off and was like, nope, never mind. And then it just, like, poured flowers all over this guy. Like, to me, I'm like, it's just too far from the real person for me to think that it was, I don't know, like, I just have, like, a sour taste in my mouth because I just feel like it was, like, an injustice to the real person. But I don't know, like, because I don't know how the book ends. And you did say that, you know, Ishido got that to happen to him in his way. And so, again, I think that that is, like, a more realistic, like, savagery thing. I just feel like maybe they tried to, like, flower up Toronaga a little too much in this.
The ending of the book is super similar. All this same stuff happens. The Erasmus is sunk. There's a lot of talking. There's not any fighting. There's that scene that I mentioned about Buntaro finding out that he'd been divorced a few days from Toronaga.
And he found that out after?
After, yeah.
After she died, right?
After she died, yeah.
Okay.
And then there's that long epilogue that is similar to the discussion that he had with Yabu, but it was all just to himself.
Okay. And
yeah.
So it was the same reason, the fact that the flag that the little Taiko or Lady Ochiba pulled the army.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
in that case, and
although
I have to accept it.
He had to tell everybody, I guess, that he wouldn't try to take on little Taiko's army if he saw it. However, I think the subtext is that, yes, he would have. At that point, if it had come down to it, then he would have.
Okay.
So I was a bit disappointed that I didn't get to see a battle scene. I have no context of, like, the historical stuff nor the book. So I'm going at this purely from somebody who just really wanted to watch the show and thought it was super cool. And so selfishly, I did want to see a battle scene just because I wanted to see up close in front a historically accurate execution. of what their battles are. And so I did get excited during the little flash or the strategy reveal. I thought that I was going to get to see it at least like in that sequence. And so it was, I thought they looked super cool in all of their uniforms. So that made me happy to have seen that. I was disappointed not seeing an actual battle go through, but I ended up just kind of pivoting and told myself, like, I don't own the storytelling here. And that's just wasn't meant to be the story that I was supposed to follow. So I just refocused back to what was just actually happening and how do I digest it to make it make sense for me and how I interpreted it. And I found this episode to be very poetic, which tends to be a more difficult for me to interpret. So I'm like you, Paul. I lean in on Gabby for these kinds of moments. And then I just kind of had to focus on, like, you know, I have to look at it all for my own interpretation too, based off what I've picked up the entire season that is special to me. And I ended up with a bit of a different conclusion than what I've read other people have, what Gabby's mentioned earlier of what it is. And I think that they're all correct in the same way that they could all also be wrong, right? So I'm like happy with the interpretation that I've taken away from this. To me, it still ended up being very powerful and didn't need to have the big battle scene.
Yeah, I mean, if it is exactly pretty much like the book, then I definitely have to accept that because this is based on the book. I guess it's just my own bias of appreciating Torunaga's real person and the real history. And I'm just, it's just, he's just so crazy, so much crazier. And I'm like, show us, give us more. Maybe I just didn't want it to end.
Yeah. This important reminder for watchers of the show and listeners of the podcast, right? That this is a historical fiction at the end of the day. And so we just have to accept it for its own story.
And apparently, yeah, it did well by the book. So that's something that I have to appreciate. So, okay, fine. Moving on. So more wrapping things up. Soon after that, we have Blackthorn and Fuji letting go of their past, accepting their present and future. Sad and sweet moment when she says that she'd rather he drop the rosary on his own so that he's the last one to touch her. That was really sad.
I cried during their scene alone at the house and that sweet conversation. And then I cried again here for this interaction. I just love Fuji.
Did
so
you
much.
Cry too, Paul?
No, I did not cry, but I did get some significance, I guess, from that, you know, this is not her custom at all. They hang on to the remains. No burials at sea, but she still went along with it. And he dropping the rosary into the water also was, I don't know, it was a nice, poignant scene. It was new. It did not happen like that in the book. So I didn't know that that was coming. Nothing along that line those happened at all.
Well, you know, Inez, you did mention how Buntaro is like a super soldier, super samurai. I mean, I believe that, but I think it's also kind of funny how they really emphasize that at the very end in the last scene when they're pulling out the ship and Blackthorn gives up until Buntaro comes and suddenly Blackthorn thinks, okay, never mind, we've got this. And then they do. They do got this.
I thought that it was like a crew with Buntaro also like added on to a third robe and something there. Was it just him being added and then that was it?
That's all we saw was just him.
Oh, I think I just assumed or something that there's more people that came up.
I thought it was him and maybe like one or two other people. Didn't a couple people bow?
There was only a little couple that came with Buntaro to that scene, but I only saw him man the rope, so I don't know.
Yeah, anyway, okay, super samurai.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely was, like, to me, one of the first and only super unrealistic thing that I've seen happen in the show was them pulling out a giant ship that is filled with water, along with whatever else like might still be in there, but it's submerged in water. Then they're pulling it out manually like that and making such big progress super quickly. I think you have to have way more manpower and support to like make that happen.
You're just saying that you think they need more than about 50 guys.
No, yeah. I think that it's fine. I mean, obviously it gets heavier as they're out of the water, but they had a lot of guys here. Anyway. Yeah, I think it's okay. Anyway, but thanks for that. I don't know. I think this very last scene, though, it again, very much A Time to Kill vibes. I mean, it's an exceptional movie, A Time to Kill, but just at the very end when it's just these two guys just smiling at each other. There are a bunch of GIFs about it and memes about it. And that's just, I just could not help but see that at the end of this, where everybody's just like, let me smile and nod. And that's the man language. So, Paul, what do you think? Was this super deep for you? Am I just a woman who doesn't understand like the significance of
the nodding?
Nod, smile and nod. Everything else is fine.
I don't know about all that, but I do think it was kind of interesting that Torunaga didn't get a bow, just a sup.
And yeah, he was okay with that.
You know, yeah. I don't know what to analyze about that, but it was, I don't know, like reassessing how to deal with him at this point, knowing that he's getting dicked around with. But he gets a chance to build his boat. Right. So, you know, at least he's doing something he likes.
Okay. Well, that makes me feel better. I like that. I can accept that.
But I suppose if you wanted to add just a cheese label to something, it would be the Buntaro joining in. Buntaro's hated his guts this whole time.
Well, now that he found out he's divorced, well, I'm sure that's implied there.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. But I don't know.
It's like all broken. These are all broken. Like as hollow and lost and everything that Blackthorn is, like Buntaro is there too, just as much, you know? So, and all of them.
Yeah, and maybe it is a like, Mariko's out of the picture, so we can be friends now since we're not fighting over property, right? No? Are they just going to be sad together for her? Are they going to be friends in spirit of her, just like the Catholic? I don't know. I like took all of this so seriously, and now that I got to the very end, which you're right, it's post-climax. I don't know. Mariko's gone, so everyone else is just B-roll.
That's basically it.
Never mind. Fuji. She's fantastic, too. Anyway, well, I don't know. Everyone was exceptional. This is a really great story. I think that the author of Shogun is great for writing his version of this so that we could have this nice cinematic masterpiece before our eyes, bringing us all together, expanding our minds.
Yeah, not just the author, but the showrunners, the inclusion of the right people at the producer level to make sure that it honors the book and does probably a better job honoring feudal Japan in a more thoroughly researched and up-to-date kind of way, as opposed to the book. And I think you'll find a lot of critics agree with that.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, the book started it, right? It inspired two shows that were accepted widely for their time. So that's really interesting that, you know, the 80s version obviously was dated, but was ahead of its time. And now they did a great job at cleaning it up and making it acceptable today. I like this progress that we've been able to see.
Let's hope awards season pays attention. This early.
Oh, definitely. Show. This show's going to win. Like,
I hope everybody wins, all the actors. Well, do you think Blackthorn is going to be, or Cosmo is going to be nominated?
I think so. He did a great.
For Maine, right?
I think so.
Oh, I hadn't heard of him, Cosmo, before this. And what I've seen is that other critics are picking him out as saying, like, this is the big jump in career for him that he needed to keep getting big roles like this.
Well, so he and Hiroyuki Sanada then are probably the main characters.
And Mariko. And then, Mariko, yeah.
Oh, right. But that was like the main men. I'm thinking about the categories.
Oh, so, yeah. Yeah, those two.
So Hiroyuki and Cosmo would be going against each other. And then maybe Yabu and Omi or Buntaro for supporting.
They'd be supporting.
Yeah, but they'd be going against
Yabu
each other.
Yabu for sure.
And then leading lady, we have one. I don't know if any supporting, but they should get it.
I loved Lady Ochiba and I loved Fujisama so much. But Lady Ochiba, I don't know, that one just like stands out so much to me.
All right. Well, you better pick some winners because they're going to be going against each other, hopefully.
So well, and
pick
I bet your favorites. Some technical categories like costume.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but they're not going against each other. That's what I was.
Oh, okay.
Of course, hopefully they win because we are partial to this show and we want everything good for them. But not all of the actors can win when they're against each other.
It's an embarrassment of riches.
True. We don't even, I mean, it does mean something to them, I'm sure.
I don't know that this is the role that would win Cosmo the big prize. Who knows? But Hiroyuki Sanada has had a long career of good work, but not that level of recognition in his work here. This might be the time to get it. This might be the show and mm-hmm. the time to get it.
I'm sure he'll get it with like as a producer or as a choreographer. He's involved in a lot of ways, so he'll be nominated multiple times.
Do you think Cosmo learned Japanese just for this show, like in his scenes? Or do you think he already knew some Japanese and that's why they brought him in?
No.
He learned it for the show?
Yeah. Right.
And I think that that's like really great. And I thought about a lot about that. So I feel like that this is a role that actually like he could win something. Maybe he'll be listed as a supporting character. Felt like a main character to me.
Well, all right, guys. That sounds like we've about run out of shit to talk about on Shogun. There's no indication that there will be a season two. There's no source material, and the showrunners don't want to go without source material. So that doesn't mean that FX wouldn't or couldn't continue with other showrunners that are more interested in continuing, but they would need to also get the interest of all the other major players we've been talking about. And then they'd have to kind of start rewriting history. I think it would be a pretty big task to get right. I think there's the chance of getting it wrong is way better than the chance of getting it right.
Yeah, I definitely don't anticipate any kind of season two, but I do hope that this show and the standard, the bar that they've set so high and how it's received so well, this is the kind of content people want. It's not necessarily the Shogun story. It's the care and respect of teaching us all about like the historical accuracy of the environment, of the resources, of the ways, and then showing the cultures. And I would love to see the respect and detail of the costumes, the settings, everything, all of that, and hope that it influences another round and wave of content that meets these kind of things. Because this is the kind of stuff that I really love watching. So they did it so right. So I'm okay that there's not going to be a Shogun season two. I'm not looking for Shogun season two. I'm looking for stellar high quality content just like this.
Well said. Okay, guys. Well, it's been super fun talking about this show with you. Our episodes got longer and longer and longer as the show got deeper and deeper and deeper, but it didn't feel that way. It felt like there was just still more that needed to be talked about. So it was very fun to be able to do that with you two.
Likewise, sir. Likewise. I don't know what my life is going to be.
It's going to be
now
Beacon.
The Shogun's gone.
It's going to be all...
You're right. Yay! Never mind.
If you like listening to us, do consider checking us out on our Beacon 23 podcast. We've done season one and we're almost halfway through season two now. It's this same level of charming compatibility amongst three hosts chatting about stuff that they like to watch. Wouldn't you guys agree? Especially with the charming part?
Absolutely.
I don't know, man. I think there's a little bit more action over there. I think we agree a lot over here. If you want some drama, hop on over to Beacon 23 Podcast.
Three hosts in the Beacon. That's right. We are officially sponsored by Boat Rocker, the production company behind Beacon 23. So that's a vote of confidence that we're doing something right on that podcast. So check us out. If you liked this podcast, please consider leaving a rating or a review on this or the Pod Clubhouse main feed, or go check us out on Beacon 23's feed. All that would be great. Leave us a message or a feedback. And at this point, there's no more podcast of Shogun to get back to you with, but we could write a message back to you through the website or Instagram or Facebook or wherever you find us. So thanks for a lot for listening this whole season.
Yeah, and actually, could we give a special shout out?
Okay, specially shouted out.
Yeah, I would like to give a special shout out to a recent reviewer.
Oh, yeah.
Who decided to give us some constructive criticism. As I've said it before, or as Inez has said it, actually, there's no such thing as bad publicity. And fortunately, our reviewer left us a little note. You know, I think Melody said that they're tired of Game of Thrones talk. And you know what, Melody? I'm right there with you, sister or brother or they. However, we accept the feedback and we love to listen. So feel free to elaborate on that and up the star ranking if you feel like it. Because that would be most good and appreciated, and we care.
Most good. That would be most good.
Most good.
It's too bad that they did not listen to the second episode where we swore off the Game of Thrones references and only did that in the first episode.
We only get five seconds to impress Paul.
I guess.
There's a lot. But that's okay because our podcasts are up there, right? And it's forever. So I'm sure Melody will listen on. And if she's listening now or he or they are listening now, then there you go. They have a second chance to make it right.
I mean, we got up to 20th ranked podcast for TV and film in Japan, so that's not nothing.
Oh, thanks, Japan.
Yeah.
They were okay with that little short bit of Game of Thrones content. But you know what? Constructive criticism, we appreciate it. So thank you for talking to us. Right. And everyone else, feel free to talk to us some more, maybe about some positive things too, because that's like nice and what makes the world go around, right?
Definitely.
Anyway, yes. Thank you all. Special shout out. Can't wait to read the other reviews because I'm sure we'll get them.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.